So I interviewed a prospective coaching client one time, and I asked how I could be most helpful. The answer, and I almost laughed right out loud until I realized he was serious, like really serious. His answer was, "We just need a billionaire. Can you help lead us to a billionaire?" This person was not coachable, which is, by the way, why I interview prospective clients. And I tell you the story not because it's ridiculous, but it is ridiculous, but to make a point. To be really good at fundraising, you need to be all about relationships, identifying them, building them, nurturing them, and sustaining them. And I think this is where we often fall just a little bit short. You also need to be knowledgeable about trends. Because when you stop and think about it, I know you have a million questions, right? At least one is top of mind. It's an election year. How do I cut through the clutter? Or maybe I can't and I should just lower my revenue targets. But wait, there's more. How do I engage young people in philanthropy? Are there topics people particularly care about? How can I count on my board to help me fundraise? Is philanthropy still driven by men? Does a commitment to DEI matter only to donors who identify as diverse? Is society getting more philanthropic? And if not, what would have to be true for that to happen? I could go on, and so could you. But I have an idea. Why don't I stop talking and introduce you to the vice chairman of CCS Fundraising, Tom Kassain. Since 1947, CCS has empowered many of the world's greatest organizations to advance some of the most important causes in history. I really love the last line in the description of their firm. While the results of our work are immediate, our impact is enduring. Let's ask Tom a bunch of questions and see if we can stump him. I'm thinking there's not a chance. Greetings and welcome to Nonprofits Are Messy. I'm your host, Joan Gary, founder of the Nonprofit Leadership Lab, where we help smaller nonprofits thrive. I'm also a strategic advisor for executive directors and boards of larger nonprofits. I'm a frequent keynote speaker, a blogger, and an author on all things leadership and management. You can learn more at joangary.com. I think of myself as a woman with a mission to fuel the leadership of the nonprofit sector. My goal with each episode is to dig deep into an issue I know that nonprofit leaders are grappling with by finding just the right person to offer you advice and insights. Today is no exception. Tom Kassain is fortunate enough to have spent his 30-year professional fundraising career exclusively with CCS. During that time, he has partnered with hundreds of extraordinary organizations in designing, implementing, and providing strategic oversight to over 1,000 fundraising initiatives. The programs for which Tom has provided counsel have raised more than $3 billion on cumulative goals of $2.5 billion. I think he's an overachiever. Tom's area of expertise includes feasibility and planning studies, landscape analyses, development audits, philanthropic assessment programs, major capital campaigns, annual giving efforts, endowment fundraising, and board recruitment. He focuses on major gift identification and solicitation, campaign management, and client relations. Tom serves on a number of boards. He also serves on the editorial review board of Giving USA, and he resides in Douglasson, Queens, with his wife, Shalini, and their daughters, Leela and Priya. Speaking of being fortunate, I am fortunate to be related to Tom Kassain. His grandmother and my grandfather were siblings, Molly and Jimmy Gary. So I had to re-Google it just to be correct. We are second cousins. Greetings, cousin and kindred spirit in the business of uplifting the nonprofit sector.
Greetings, Joan. I am so glad that we are not second cousins once removed, because I want to be as attached to you as I possibly can. Really, so wonderful to be with you. And I look forward to this conversation. And just, I need to say one thing early on. We are so fortunate in this work, in this industry, to have someone who is so clear, but more importantly, so candid about the impact of philanthropy, the role of boards, and how we continue to drive this enormous level of generosity. Thanks, Joan, for inviting me today and for your work.
So sweet. Thank you. You know how you look at a resume, Tom? You probably looked at a few thousand over the years, right? And you think, wow, there's a lot of bouncing on that resume. That person really bounces around a lot. You have zero bounce. You have never worked anywhere but CCS. I don't think I actually know anyone but you that spent an entire career in one place. I'm thinking you maybe you really, really like it, or maybe you have a serious case of inertia. I need to know more.
Well, it's probably inertia, but the point about having zero bounce, since no one can see me, they could probably guess why I don't have a zero bounce. But yeah, I've spent literally 35 years with CCS. This month marks 35 years with the firm. And as the two of us are sort of family, right? the firm is family. My father started in 1952, my brother in 1979, and I started a decade later in 1999, and about three or four other crazy Kassanes joined the firm over the last several decades as well. So yes, my only job before this was at the Sports Connection, Joan, in Little Neck, Queens, selling sneakers in 1987, I think. That's about the last job I had.
Wow. Just being part of a family business, clearly it roots you. I mean, it isn't a family business. It's now a massive global enterprise, right? But does it root you in a, maybe this isn't a fair question, but does it root you in a good way?
Yeah, I think it does. I think, you know, the thing I think I learned about the family dynamic is I have eight brothers and sisters. So I'm the second youngest of nine. And I think we would all say as brothers and sisters that we competed to be our parents' favorite, right? That's just common dynamic. I was my parents' favorite. There's no question about it, okay?
I'm not sure that's what I've heard, but that's fine.
My parents' favorite.
I'm going to have to take your word for it.
My mom was so good at giving us each the individual impression that we were her favorite. And I'd like to think that we offer to our clients in a very genuine way that they're our favorite. We treat them with the same respect and the same level of interest. So I think that's kind of a family ethos that's carried over into the firm over so many decades.
Yeah, I love that. At what point did you realize that CCS was going to be this big mammoth place?
Yeah, good question. I mean, we are a very well-resourced firm. We have offices throughout the country and also in Europe. I think it was at the time when it was probably about 15 years ago, roughly 15 years ago, it probably tied to the Great Recession of 2008 through 2011, right? We all remember the last quarter of 2008 with the Great Recession. And the rebound from that, which the country enjoyed and philanthropy finally enjoyed, was a couple of years later, Joe. So there was this extraordinary appetite in around 2010 for all nonprofits to rely more on philanthropy. And then all of a sudden, not just the large mega nonprofits, but the midsize and smaller ones embraced it. And that was probably the spark that then suggested that our firm could be helpful to any number of clients. And so a firm that used to work in four or five sectors, now we work in all 11 nonprofit sectors. So that was probably the time. It was a result of an extraordinary initiative. And candidly, since the pandemic, that's another inflection point in the work that we both do.
Yeah, we'll come back. We're going to come back to philanthropy and the pandemic, and we can talk a little bit about that. I was actually just curious. I happen to know some of this. Your family started by sort of raising money for like local churches, right?
Yeah, exactly right. So our shared grandparents, right? West Side of Manhattan, Irish Catholic, West Side of Manhattan. And if we start to talk about the presidential election, this podcast is going to go for about 5 or 6 days, right? Tangent alert for everyone. You've got a Gary and a Kassane on the same podcast. But yeah, my grandfather was an elected politician on the West Side of Manhattan, and he was asked to chair his parish campaign, Holy Cross Church on 42nd and 10th. And my father was just out of law school. He went to law school on the GI Bill. And so this was early 1950. And at that point, there was getting away from the law into something a little bit more impactful. So it started back then, literally when my grandfather was asked to chair a very huge campaign back then, Joan, that was $75,000.
Actually, you know, that's a big number for some organizations. That's still a big number, actually.
Sure is. It sure is, no doubt.
Fascinating. So I was going to ask you what you love about fundraising, but I think it'll come out in this question. What do folks say when you tell them what you do? I wondered, actually, do folks, after they diplomatically tell you just how admirable you are, say anything like, oh my gosh, I could never do anything like that, or that would be a terrifying line of work for me? I'm actually curious, how do those conversations go?
Yeah, so the first thing is, after you try to explain to them what you do, everyone says, well, can you raise money for me? I've got three kids going off to college. So then you get through that and you get humbled a little bit. But the next reaction is, wait a second. So you ask people for money. And I'm like, at times, I mean, that's not what we're authorized to do, because we're, you know, fundraising consultants and we have a legitimate license with the Attorney General's office, blah, blah, blah. But when you share with them that what we do is partner with nonprofits when they've got a really good idea or they've got a big problem, and Do they have this promising opportunity to strengthen or accelerate or discover or expand or protect? Or are they challenged and they need to save something or they need to secure something? And so that's when they realize that the job is different and the job has a deep connection with the mission of the nonprofit, but more importantly, the people that lead it, right? That's our job, is to partner with those folks, give them the confidence to do it candidly.
So let's get down to some business. I did actually frame about 4,000 questions, and we might have time for a few of them.
Let's get to 3,000.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. There have been more than a few election years in your tenure. I often hear staff and board talk about lowering expectations, and I'm not sure I buy it. I feel like in election years, people see themselves as citizens, and they get riled up about issues. And the issues that candidates talk about are about making the world better, safer, like the sweet spot of the nonprofit sector. So one could argue that they should or are more engaged. What does history tell you about that?
Yeah, so let's stay on history for a minute, right? So since they've been keeping sort of philanthropic records over the last almost 45 years since 1979, there have been 11 presidential elections, okay? We're on the eve of the 12th. 9 of the 11, there was increase in that election year. So starting in 1984, all the way to 2020, there was an increase in giving. There was one year where it stayed the same, and that was in 1980, when giving was about 25% of what it is today. And there was one year that went down, and that was 2008. And 2008, as you recall, the last 100 days of the year, from September 15th, when Lehman Brothers collapsed and then the housing crisis took place, that's when we saw it. So Americans are tremendously resilient. So 9 out of 11, there's been no decrease. 1 out of 11, it was the same, and that was 45 years ago. And the only time that the country witnessed a decrease in an election year was 2008 at the Great Recession. So that's what history tells us. But Joan, this is going to be a little bit different election.
Do tell.
Well, we've got a rematch. It hasn't been a rematch in a long time. So when was the last time there was a rematch? Number two, this is a very long general election. You know, if you follow the news and, you know, whatever the polls tell us, it looks like that the two leading candidates of both political parties have it wrapped up, and they've got it wrapped up now before any other election. So this general election is going to be 10 months long. At least. So that's different. So I think this distraction will linger longer and it will be on our minds earlier. So in previous, you know, presidential elections, you started to hear the anxiety in the late spring and the summertime around the conventions. I think you're going to hear it a little bit earlier this year. And I think the third reason is because we have such unknown candidates. We don't know who these two guys are. They're very young. You know, they have, there's no brand to these two.
Right.
They're infants, they're children. And so, you know, it's going to be different. These are, you know.
I think the length of time is a really good point. And
so I wouldn't temper goal setting, Joan.
No, you wouldn't, right? No.
No, I wouldn't. I mean, the history tells us. I mean, two other things to think about here, and just to spend a second on it.
Sure.
Political giving is up. It's doubled over the past two elections. So two elections ago, 6% of Americans gave to a presidential election. In 2020, it was 12%.
That's a big jump.
Big jump. And it was tied to a younger audience. At the time, it was more generation, more the millennial generation than Generation Z 4 years ago, right?
Right.
You know, what we know about generational giving, especially Z and millennials, is they want to be in the game, right? They're social activists. And so I think you're seeing that more present in political fundraising than in nonprofit fundraising. I am not a political fundraiser. I just observe certain trends and see how they affect us.
That makes sense. And we'll come back to the age and philanthropy in a couple of minutes. I was really struck by something I was going through. So CCS does a very comprehensive look at annual philanthropic trends, and downloading the most recent report, which is 2023. You could do so at ccsfundraising.com, which is exactly what I did, and I actually read it. So I'd like to focus on a few lessons learned from 2023 that, in my mind, sort of present interesting opportunities. So the first one, maybe we qualify this one as missed opportunities. I'm not sure. Let's see what you think. Charitable giving is now back down to pre-pandemic levels. Why couldn't we sustain that level of giving? Did the sector miss an opportunity to continue to nurture people who got in the game, as you put it, in a big way? And could we have done something to kick the total up and keep it at the higher level?
Oh, wow. And so here's sort of the confluence of events, right? So the pandemic started, at least in the US, in early March of 2020. So presidential election year, right? You also had the horrifying events with George Floyd and the tragedies around that. But you saw immediate spikes in giving to global health because of the pandemic. You saw significant spikes in terms of social justice and DEI. And you saw huge spikes in voter turnout and raising monies for advocacy. And so you had these three big things that sort of collided. And so I don't know if the sector was ready to handle three things rather than just one or two. Secondly, sadly, like a lot of things, what is current and vibrant and robust and necessary sort of wanes away. And then I will say something that I think we are challenged in our shared work, Joan. There's enormous fluidity in the nonprofit world at the executive level, at the board level, and at the development level. So you see a lot of people in and out. So it's hard to maintain momentum over 2 or 3 or 4 years. So what could we have done better? You know, giving is fairly predictable in terms of where it's going to come from. So individual giving, corporate giving, foundation giving. Corporate giving has struggled in the last 2 decades. We know that. In two ways, it's remained flat in terms of a percentage of overall revenue at about 5%. But all the statistics tell us that corporate giving is about 0.9% of profits. 20 years ago, it was 2% of profits. Huge drop. And of course, foundations is quite significant, especially family foundations. Did we miss an opportunity? I think so. There was an article in the Chronicle Philanthropy back in late December where there was an issue around giving to faith-based organizations as well, Joan. So faith-based giving gets about 30 cents of every dollar, but it's decreasing. And the message that was, I believe, attempted through this article was, how does a decrease in giving to faith-based organizations, how will that affect generosity and philanthropy overall? In the sense that where do people learn to give? Often at home and often at a place of worship. So you've got a lot of things that are happening right now, post-pandemic, fluidity in the business, shrinking giving to faith-based organizations, flatlining of corporate giving, a rise in AI. You had a great podcast about that. And as well as, you know, the digital presence, which is just something that is just so critical for especially the smaller and mid-sized nonprofit.
Yep, lots and lots of things to think about. I was struck by the report also talked about particular sectors that saw growth in 2023.
Yeah, and so a couple of things there. You know, the sectors I think that you would expect, right, you would expect are the big three. Again, faith-based organizations, higher ed, human services, right? And if you include hospitals in there, three of the four have inherent donor bases, don't they, Joan? So a faith-based organization has worshipers. Colleges have graduates. Hospitals have grateful patients. The other seven sectors do not have an inherent donor base. So as my dad, we reference my family, as my dad used to say, some organizations you fundraise and some organizations you collect money. That's unfair. It's unfair. But yeah, you're seeing up and down. So for instance, you know, the areas that increased were international affairs, more monies. That could be consistent again in 2023. The report comes out in June because of the sadness in both Ukraine and the sadness in the Middle East, right? You could see that.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's not even what's happening in the rest of the world. That's just two things that are on the front page. And you saw some decreases. Wait, my Queen's accent just came out. Did you hear that, Joan? You saw them. No, you saw some decreases. I don't know if you hear my Queen's accent. For all of you on the podcast who are from Queens, you know what I'm talking about.
Okay. Carry on, but Mr. Kassane.
Yeah, you did see decreases. And we talked about, you know, faith-based organizations and human services did witness big decreases, giant decreases.
Let's talk about, how about in the, and again, it's on, this probably crosses many of these sectors, but philanthropy that is thematically BIPOC, right? and the connection with DEI. Talk a little bit about what you have seen there. Yeah, I'd be really interested.
Yeah, I love the way you describe that thematically, BIPOC. I hear you. So we're seeing a few things. One is intentional recruitment of board members. Thorough, mindful, intentional consideration of board members. Please, in our experience, that it's not superficial. And what we're witnessing is that it's very real. So I think that's encouraging.
Very.
Right, Joan? I think the second thing that we're witnessing, which is also promising, is a fair, proportionate demonstration of who serves and who gets served. In other words, highlighting those organizations that foster the work, right, to drive philanthropy, to ensure not just social justice, but basic fairness. You're seeing large giving, for instance, to tremendously profound organizations like the NAACP, the National Urban League, La Raza, really impressive. You see these mega donors making groundbreaking, what we call role model giving, right? You've seen these nine-figure commitments to drive access and affordability. You see huge sort of fundraising campaigns around inclusion. I am very buoyed by this. And of course, you know, you start out a little skeptical. Is this real? Will this be something that will be carried through? I am super, super hopeful for this. So the point you made earlier, did the sector miss an opportunity during the pandemic? I don't think we're going to miss an opportunity here because it's just got great momentum.
I'm actually really encouraged to hear you talk about that.
The Nonprofit Leadership Lab is led by Joan Gary and is the world's best online community for leaders of small nonprofits. Learn how to raise more money, build the board of your dreams, grow a large audience of supporters, and so much more. To learn more and request an invitation to become a member, please go to nonprofitleadershiplab.com/podcast. That's nonprofitleadershiplab.com/podcast.
We're chatting with my second cousin, but more importantly, the vice chairman of CCS Fundraising. There isn't anything that Tom doesn't do or know around philanthropy, and we really are second cousins. And we are talking about trends in philanthropy. He has the benefit of a long, rich history with CCS, and I'm learning a lot, and we're not done yet. So the two other big buckets for me that I would love to hear you talk about are millennials and their money, and Gen Zs and their money. So from your study, $84 trillion, that's trillion dollars, will pass from one generation to the next through 2045. Generation X will potentially inherit the greatest amount of these assets, estimated to be $8.9 trillion in the next 10 years and a total of $29.6 trillion over the next 25 years. And I actually haven't talked about the millennial households. We can talk about them in a moment, but let's go to these Gen X's.
Well, as a member of the Gen X generation, I can't wait to inherit $84 trillion, okay? But again, Joan, you and I, although we are second cousins, we didn't come from that, right? So by the way, there's two pieces of evidence to prove that Joan and I are cousins. My confirmation name, so maybe 5% of this audience will know what that means. It's a name you get when you receive a sacrament when you're about 12 years old, is Gary, G-A-R-R-Y. There's proof. And the second proof that we are related is that neither one of us have an upper lip, okay? And so those of you who've met us, that's absolute proof. So a couple things. That number is very real. And some of the economists believe actually that number could be conservative. I think what it's going to tell us is a few things. One is there's an enormous responsibility for Gen X and eventually millennials and Generation Z, enormous amount of responsibility. Number two, we have to foster this notion of philanthropy so that those assets are indeed used for the better good, right? So Joan, look up the word philanthropy in the dictionary, right? It's not fundraising. It's
love
for the betterment of humankind.
Love of humankind. Yep.
Right. And so we have to reinforce it. I'd say a couple of other things is, so what does that mean? Well, this great wealth transfer also tells us, of course, that the financial advisors of the world are going to be very busy planning giving, future giving. trusts, insurance, codicils and wills, bequests, massive. There's a deep competition for it. It's remarkable that the average American household, whatever that means today, right, Joan, with the 1% and everybody else, what is an average American household, right? Because your household is average, right? And my household is average.
Mine is average with a twist, Tom.
And mine's pretty average with a tiny bit of a twist too, as you know.
Indeed.
Well, what you've got there is that the average household starts their estate planning at 44, and the first plan gift is at 53. So if you're a nonprofit, if you're in the development shop, you need to understand this. You need to embrace plan giving as a critical revenue source, and you have to recognize that you've got to equip your executive officers, your CEOs, your executive directors, and your board members to invest in this.
How?
And yeah, please. No, I was sorry. Just one last thing on it is it then makes its way, of course, down to millennials and Generation Z, because family foundations will be created out
Correct.
Of all of this.
So I'll read the other piece of data, and then I really want to sort of hone in on, okay, so what does a nonprofit do with that information, right? So here's the millennial and those that are on the cusp. With the great wealth transfer in motion and many Americans over 55 years old opting to pass down some of their estates while living, the younger generation's wealth and philanthropic capacity are on the rise, like currently on the rise, right? Between 2016 and 2022, the average millennial household annual giving increased by 40%, right? So, you know, I have three kids in their 20s and 30s. This is when they settle down, they buy houses, they have kids, right? I'm gonna wait for them to tap into, you know, the shekels I've saved up so that they can have the money to buy the house they couldn't afford to buy back then. That's nuts, right? So we've got, like, there's money coming at young people. I mean, not all young people, right? But money coming to young people. What? Nonprofits aren't all that good at identifying, cultivating, and stewarding young people, or they're not thinking about them as prospects. Tell me, if I run a nonprofit, what am I supposed to do with that information, Tom? Because there's gold in them, their hills.
Gold in them, their hills. You know, Joan, first of all, I said it before, you're amazing. I love your energy. It is so authentic. And so a couple things. First thing they got to do about it is they got to let their respective boards know about it. This is not a data point. This needs to be cultural and embedded in the leadership of a nonprofit. This is a big deal. Secondly, they've got to invest in the fundraising offices, right? So I would imagine that a number of the folks that are, you know, devotees of Joan Gary are fundraising practitioners, and they have to convince their boards to invest in their shops and in plan giving. The third thing is to make the mystery of future giving and the mystery of all how to handle this money less mysterious. What we find a lot is nonprofits tell us that someone wrote a letter, they got a letter from an attorney, and they got a $50,000 check. And we had no idea it was coming.
I actually have had that experience.
They should have. And so communication to your donors about the ease of giving, how to be responsible with your giving, and naturally demonstrating the impact of your work. So I would hire young people. So you have peer-to-peer understanding. Don't be afraid. It's okay to hire someone out of college. It's perfectly fine because they're going to relate. Number two, I would spend considerable time creating advisory committees, ad hoc committees of lawyers, of financial advisors, of wealth guidance. It doesn't have to be part of your governance structure or your bylaw, right, Joan? You could have a group of six or seven women and men, whomever, huddling with you and giving you advice along the way. But the third thing is, let's never forget, whether it was in 1979 when they first started recording, you know, generosity in this country, or last year, it is a competition. Anyone who doesn't think it's a competition doesn't have the edge. And I would encourage that edge. And you compete for good board members, you compete for a narrative, you compete for dollars, you compete for donors. And once you get those donors, you've got to retain them. It is a deep sense of competition. Don't think it isn't.
It's so funny because I recorded a podcast this morning with the CEO of Feeding America.
Yeah.
And we talked about this very subject. Claire Babineau Fontenot. This sounds like someone from Louisiana, doesn't it? And
does. I want some gumbo.
Indeed, she is. And she came from Walmart. She was an EVP of finance at Walmart. Never had stepped foot in a nonprofit organization. She decides to leap to the largest U.S. charity or in revenue, like $3 billion or something. And that's exactly what we talked about, is this sort of competition, because Feeding America is like the biggest kid in the kid in the sandbox with the biggest, shiniest dump truck, right? And that whole, I mean, I wish it wasn't so, but, you know, it's there, right?
It's so there. I mean, Feeding America is fabulous. I mean, their mission in terms of food insecurity, sadly, is incredibly relevant. It's sad, right? And it's increasing. There's no question about it. And our firm has been very privileged to collaborate with the national office and some of the affiliates and chapters. And so we know firsthand how impactful Feeding America is and the job that she has in front of us. But I'm so happy to hear that there's a sense that even though they're large and they're multinational and are organized and have a brand to them, that they recognize that the $500 billion that was given away last year, $500 billion, which is crazy, is not something that happens, you know, purely through direct mail or a really good email or some ice bucket challenge. It involves a very thoughtful approach. And I just give credit to all of our partners and colleagues who are the million plus development people out there who do this remarkable, impactful, catalytic work. Great.
One of the ways, if you are an executive director and you're listening to this podcast, I have this idea. Tom suggested that you educate your boards about the money coming to younger Americans, right? So why don't you share this podcast with them, make it a pre-listen before your next board meeting, and set aside some time to actually talk about the implications of what Tom's sharing here, and have a conversation about what implications they have for you and what you could be doing differently or better. Because two things are true. The money is there, and this is a cohort of humans that arrived somehow wanting to be part of something bigger. And that's what you're selling. Don't you think, Tom?
So I think I just something bigger, right? It goes back to the whole notion of philanthropy again, for the betterment of humankind. And so you and I are obviously very privileged to be in this space, right? Because we see the work over and over again. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about fundraising during a presidential year. There's anxieties around that, right? But what we would recommend in terms of sort of garnering your fair share of that $84 trillion and doing it in 2024 in a presidential year is don't stop fundraising. Do not. Don't lower expectations at all. Secondly, reach out to your donors more, not less. You can reach out to them in very elegant ways. You don't have to pick their pocket in every communication, but communicate with them. And then the third thing I think that's particularly important to think about is a multi-streamed revenue source. So if you're a smaller nonprofit, which is overly dependent upon special events, pivot. If you're a nonprofit that depends upon 60% giving from 12 board members, pivot and engage in a deep appreciation for your own mission. Read it again, read your own mission. If there was no such thing as XYZ nonprofit that you represent, would you start it? Would you be a founder? And
ooh,
that's your
I
new
love
message
that question.
In 2024. So if there was no such thing as Feeding America, right?
Yeah.
Would someone have come together and established Feeding America? Absolutely.
No question. It's interesting. I often not with my coaching clients, when I feel that sort of emotional lull, I tell them to go find the cover letter for the job, the cover letter they use to apply for the job.
So good. So good. It's so good. And then, yeah, it's so good. And, you know, in that same kind of maxim, as we, you know, we always rely heavily on our boards, right? Because they have fiduciary responsibilities and everything. But one of the things that I would encourage our colleagues and practitioners is board members were donors first. And so if they're donors first, what was their first attachment to that nonprofit? So in the same way that you recommend during a lull, go back to your cover letter and why do you want to work at XYZ Institution? Always keep in mind that your board members were donors first and what sparked their interest in your particular client. This is, I mean, you and I are obviously very emotional people. I mean, that's pretty obvious, even though we don't have an upper lip, but we do have strong upper lips emotionally. But this is a really fast-paced moment for philanthropy. We talked about the challenge of distractions. We talked about perhaps not seizing an opportunity over the last couple of years. The statistics tell us that giving is up, but the number of donors is down, right? But at the same time, I would just encourage everyone to recognize how resilient the American population is when it comes to philanthropy, that this is indeed a competition, and invest. Please encourage your board members to invest, because it's, I think philanthropy would be like the fourth or fifth largest sort of segment in our GDP at $500 billion a year.
I think it's number three. It's an amazing stat, actually.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. So, John, we spent some time, obviously, about the presidential election. We know that it's going to be long. We know it's a rematch. So, you know, we're encouraging folks to work through it. But what's your concern about it? What are you recommending to your clients as they confront this significant distraction?
I am worried that risk-averse boards will influence budgets and revenue targets and make an assumption that the organization has to hunker down. I think risk-averse boards is a chronic illness in the nonprofit sector. We forget that oversight means more than let's make sure nothing goes wrong. So yeah, that's for me, that's the thing, is I just wholeheartedly believe that the public square is going to be filled with divisive politics for sure, but everybody's going to be talking about issues. And most of them, if not all of them, are yours. One of them is yours, right? So climb on that platform, get a bullhorn and start talking, write an op-ed, do those kinds of visibility things, take advantage of the fact that people are talking about your issues and get out there and talk and engage more and more people. That's what I think an election year, actually, that's the opportunity. And my big worry, which is why I wanted you to come talk to me today, is that we're actually going to miss it.
Yeah. So I hear you. I think what I hear from you is you don't want boards to retreat, right? This is the exact time not to. And you could play on a board retreat, right? How many times you let a board retreat and you scratch your head and say, that's an oxymoron, because the whole intention of a board retreat is to move forward, right? But if this is a time where risk-averse boards lower expectations, don't invest in people or personnel or processes, there are 1.2 million other nonprofits in this country that will. The number of nonprofits in this country went from 650,000 to 1.2 million in just 25 years. There was only one decrease, and that was 2009, right? And there were about 90,000 nonprofits that have shrunk, but the number of nonprofits is up. And so if you retreat, if you divest, if you go into defeat, this the charity that's your neighbor isn't going to do that.
Well, and maybe let's leave it with this, is that if you retreat, you work with fewer clients. You are not as effective in the work that the other donors are counting on you. Your donors, your communities, your clients, they're counting on you. And it doesn't feel like retreating is at all an option. And if there's a way you can take the public spotlight on a particular issue and grab onto it so that you can raise more visibility and more money, don't go down swinging on that one. So
no way. That's perfect, because I just feel that, again, referring back to a podcast you had with the leadership of Feeding America, you know, those who are challenged with food insecurity will still be there, right? Those that are marginalized will still be there. Wait, now I sound like Tom Joad in the Grapes of Wrath. Wait a second. I'll be there. You remember that one? I'll be there.
I think that was Henry Fonda, was it?
Yeah, exactly right. And so, you know, nonprofits also sometimes get into the vortex of sustainability, and we're going to protect our fiscal stability. And what happens there is it's not about the 501c3.
No, is it Feeding America is part of a movement.
Yeah. And remember, Joan, 501c3, it's just a tax status. It's not a business model. It's just a tax. That's all it is.
I need to let you go. I am so grateful. Any last piece of advice for the folks who are listening?
Yes. Don't get intimidated by the trends, right? Yeah, we're numbers people. So because you want to understand what the data tells us. And I would say that the kind of the last piece of advice I would offer to everyone is building off your point about go back to your cover letter. I really, really like that, Joan, to think about why you wanted to work for XYZ institution, because it's an incredible opportunity that we have. It's an awesome responsibility that we have, But I just give credit to those folks who do it, Joan. We work with really remarkable people.
Yes.
And so hang in there. Don't worry about this rematch. It's a long presidential election, but November 5th will come and we'll get through it, Joan.
Indeed. Tom Kassane, as a cousin, a colleague, a kindred spirit, thank you so much for being with us today. And I thought that the conversation was both great and just so valuable for the folks that are listening. So thank you.
Thank you, Joan. Thank you for your work and your leadership in the space.
I hope to see you soon. And for those of you who are listening, I hope you found this really helpful. I really encourage you to share it with your board. I love sending a podcast out before a board meeting and leaving some time to talk about the implications of it. It enriches your board members. And it also, believe it or not, is a team building exercise without calling it an icebreaker. Consider that. Take good care of yourselves. Thank you for the work you do, and we'll see you next time. Thanks so much for spending time with me today. I hope you found the conversation valuable as you navigate the messy world of nonprofits. Check out all my other resources at joangary.com. Hope you find them helpful too. Lastly, thank you for the work you do to repair the world in ways large and small. I'll see you next time.